Okay. All right, I'll be right back and we'll get started.
I think so. He sounds excellent. I was coming as a guest at the A meeting, so. Oh, really? Yeah, he sounds very well, and if I heard the tour, it's awesome. He's asking Spanish, yeah, which actually would be hugely useful. Yeah, thank you for that. We're so, we're going to be members, so it's awesome.
It's funny because I'm yelling at kids all the time. We share a lot. I hear me yelling at my kids, and then yesterday, I think he had one of those dressers with where you hear like a ding a ding a ding. I heard him open his dress. Oh my god, if I can hear this guy open his dress, I've been my whole life.
Okay, yeah, it was a while ago. Yeah.
So she's unaffiliated.
No paper in 2 years.
Three years.
Wow.
It was the first class. Yeah, no, I know. Yeah, it's got a animal bio, I guess. So it's like an 8-page. But I'm on a vacation block and then academic medicine, which is pretty much a second vacation block. So I've got enough bio on my plan. I'll have plenty of time, which is good. And I still have the 5 and 601. But I have the outline back, so I just need to write it from there.
Are you interested in coming back to the IRC?
So I'll be.
They want you.
Did you take that course?
They want
the course?
Really?
Yeah.
Barbara asked me about you.
As a kid.
Yeah. 2 days ago.
So
she said, she's around, is she coming back?
I think one other one with Nora Jones. It was the same way. It's sort of 8 pages in your topic.
I forgot. I was trying to
put this
been on.
That was the luck with mine.
Maybe if I
would have
taken
it
in person, but if you've already been there and you know it.
Okay, let's get started.
Can they give you work for you?
Today, as you know from the syllabus and from the readings, today we're going to be talking about disability, disability studies, disability theory, and quite literally disabilities themselves, as they're rendered in narrative and as they're understood culturally and theoretically. I want to start to have us talk about, first, the fact that what we're doing this week actually is transitioning from the first sort of third of the class into the second third of the class. If you remember when I went over the syllabus at the beginning, the first third was about different sort of modes, if you will, of reading. So thinking about cases, thinking about testimonials, thinking about psychological profiles, you name it, different kinds of ways of reading and narratives categorically. Well, this section is about perspectives or conditions. So this section is about us thinking about what does it mean to have particular kinds of impairments, particular types of illnesses. In particular, this second section of the course is about thinking about the perspective of the infirmed, impaired, or sick person themselves. And thus, let's look at several different conditions. I wanted to start by having us look this week a disability, because really that question of disability informs how we're going to be looking at various other conditions in weeks to come. To that end, disability studies and disability theory, and we're going to talk a lot about this today, is understood very much this way. Which is to say, how big is this umbrella that disability is? What does disability mean, and what constitutes disability? At its earliest incantations, if you will, disability theory, disability studies really meant and dealt with the most literal and most obvious forms of disability we think of. Those ones that deal with physical impairments, those that deal with debilitating or limiting sort of mobility sort of conditions. So that disability had a very obvious and a very straightforward sort of meaning. But as the the identity and as the study and as the theory has developed, that very category of disability has expanded and contracted at different times depending on different conditions. So what we're going to talk a lot about today is how do we define that term disabled or disability? What does it mean to apply that term to certain conditions and not to others? And then more broadly, what does it suggest about the fact that we're trying to think about disability in relation to its opposite, which is able-bodiedness, we might say. I'd like to start by having everybody pull out the Nancy Mayer's piece called "I'm Being a Cripple." And I want to start here by giving us a testimonial of one person who is disabled and calls herself such, in particular using the term cripple. And the fact that this is a very seminal piece in disability studies, if you look at the end of it, it's copyright is of 1986, which is to say that disability studies has at its genesis about this very late 1980s, early 1990s sort of period. It really takes off at the end of the 90s and in the past probably 10 years or so, but we're talking about as a discipline of about the last, say, 20 years or so. To that end, and we're going to get to this in a second when we talk about the Leonard Davis article, I'm going back and forth a lot. Like I said, my name is Nestor. No carpet here, I'm sure. We're going to be talking about disability in relation to not just conditions, which is to say the actual conditions that one might have that renders oneself disabled, but also in relation to identity politics, which is to say communities, if you will. So what does it mean to think about a community of deaf persons or a community of people who are physically impaired or a community of people who have multiple sclerosis, so to speak? Having said that, disability studies, just to give you a little bit of a thing to think about, comes out of this very question of identity politics at a time when disability studies and what was referred to or is sometimes still referred to as trauma studies was at its genesis as well. This is in the 1990s. Trauma studies is the study of any experience, any condition, but more importantly, any moment that has really rendered one's life or one's identity traumatically changed by the, as we could say, the traumatic effect. So, for example, someone working in trauma studies might be concerned with what the experience of a rape victim in Sudan might be like in contrast to, say, someone who's like living under poverty conditions in 1920s Alabama, which is to say they're very different experiences, but how does trauma translate across time and across geography? Disability, by contrast, as a form of studies, comes about to think about what does it mean to understand one's relation to one's own body, to one's own community, and towards and relation to and reaction to other people's able-bodiedness. So to that end, Mayer's piece and all the pieces we're looking at today are concerned with how people understand their own bodies, but in particular, how do I define my body? How do I name it and label it? And how do I express it or contrast it to those that are around me, similar or different in nature? Let's look at "On Being a Cripple" by Nancy Mayer. Nancy Mayer is a teacher of writing and literature. She's also a scholar who does disability theory and also writing theory. The most important thing to know about her is that she does have multiple sclerosis, and she wrote this piece at a time when she was really coming to terms with the condition becoming rather severe rather than being just diagnosed. So this piece is about her not just coming to terms with the condition itself, but the very label of being somebody who has MS. If you look at the second paragraph of this piece, would somebody read it for us?
I will, sure.
Great.
"First, the matter of semantics. I'm a cripple. I choose this word to name me. I choose from among several possibilities, the most common of which are, quote, handicapped and, quote, disabled. I made the choice a number of years ago without thinking, unaware of my motive for doing so. Even now, I'm not sure what those motives are, but I recognize that they are complex and not entirely flattering. People, crippled or not, wince at the word cripple as they do not at handicapped or disabled. Perhaps I want them to wince. I want them to see me as a tough customer, one to whom the fates, gods, viruses have not been kind, but who can face the brutal truth of her existence squarely as a cripple, I swagger."
Okay, so let's look in more detail in a second at this paragraph, but let's first start that last sentence. As a cripple, I swagger. Somebody tell me what, paraphrase that for me, what she's actually expressing there.
She's proud.
She's proud, but more importantly, the claiming of a derogatory term has in some way actually improved the mobility, if you will, to some degree. So thinking about someone with MS or somebody thinking with a physical impairment is to speak about a kind of like impaired sort of mobility or fluidity, if you will. The use of the word swagger here seems to me really significant in the sense that it actually adds a kind of, you know, like when we say I'm a player, I swagger, you know? I mean, like, this is a real kind of point of pride, if you will, to some degree. I want to think a bit more about some of the terms she mentioned in this paragraph, but I want to read the next one and have us be thinking about the various terms that we use or could use to describe somebody who has either MS or has some kind of a physical disability, and why the use of the term cripple is a strategic one on her part. Why that term and not others? But to be fair to myself, a certain amount of honesty underlies my choice. Cripple seems to me a clean word, straightforward and precise. It has an honorable history, having made its first appearance in the Lindisfarne Gospel in the 10th century. As a lover of words, I like the accuracy with which it describes my condition. I have lost the full use of my limbs. Disabled, by contrast, suggests any incapacity, physical or mental. And I certainly don't like handicap, which implies that I have deliberately been put under a disadvantage, by whom I can't imagine. My God is not a handicapper general. In order to equalize chances in the great race of life, these words seem to me to be moving away from my condition, to be widening the gap between word and reality. Most remote is the recently coined euphemism differently abled, which partakes of the same semantic hopefulness that transformed countries from undeveloped to underdeveloped, then to less developed, and finally to developing nations. People have continued to starve in these countries during the shift. Some realities do not obey the dictates of language. All right, let's start by thinking about some of these terms then. Let's make a list up here. Disability is the term we're talking about today. But let's list all the words that we could use that are, if not synonymous, certainly could be semi-interchangeable. So we have disabled. What else? Handicapped. What else?
Incapacitated.
Crippled. If she chooses. Is it two P's?
Yeah.
Yes. Crippled. I heard incapacitated. Someone's going to have to fill that one for me. Income.
I-N-C-A-P-A-C-I-T-E-D.
Is that right? Incapacitated?
Yeah, close enough.
That's close enough. You know what I mean.
It's okay.
What else?
Differently abled.
Differently abled we've got down here.
You don't hear much more about the handy capable.
That's a good one. Handy capable. What else?
Physically challenged.
Physically challenged.
Impaired.
You have a particular challenge? Impaired, good. In fact, I'm going to star this physically challenged one because that's the one that's totally from like those of us, you know, we're all old enough. Remember like sort of the 90s, very, very PC, sort of like everything was vertically challenged, so-and-so challenged, weight challenged, right? It was like the sensitive way, like not to hurt someone's feelings. What else?
Special needs.
What's that, special needs?
Yeah.
Or just special, we could say, right? After all, it's the Special Olympics, for example. How about this one? Yep. Mm-hmm. Can you think of any other ones like that?
Like invalid.
Invalid? Is that under impaired? I'll put that here next to impaired. Any other slurs?
Gimp in years.
I know, right?
Moron.
Moron? I mean, there's...
I mean, those slurs
were
meant a whole group of people.
Right. Slow. What's that?
Well, this, I mean, like, in that SPAD special.
Oh, right.
SPADs.
SPADs,
mm-hmm.
I like that.
That's a good one.
Anything else? I mean, there's, of course, you know, idiot and dumb and... We're talking about all kinds of disability here. We're talking not just about whether you got a wheelchair, whether you got MS, but also whether you have a mental impairment, whether you have diabetes, whether you have, you're blind, deaf, you name it.
You say a lot, medically fragile.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Where do you say that?
I mean, like in medicine, mm-hmm. We'll say medically fragile children.
Mm-hmm.
Medically fragile.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say that sounds child sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Anything else?
Braille.
Braille? I like that. We can add more to this as we go on. My point is that there's an endless number of terms at our disposal with which to describe oneself. And as Nancy Mayers mentions here, some of these terms are chosen because they're hurtful or not, some because they are more inclusive, some because they're more exclusive, and each person has the right to choose the term that they want to choose. Having said that, Mayers specifically has chosen cripple, and no doubt, lover of words that she self-admits herself, she probably made a list herself like this and decided cripple's the one I like. Having read these paragraphs together and read the whole thing, why do you think she likes that one? What are the advantages of that term that she expresses in these two paragraphs or in this piece? that the others don't offer?
Well, it's specific to how she feels that her illness has changed her life. So, for example, disabled can be so much broader, it can be mental. So crippled just expresses like the physical illness of the lack of limb ability.
Good. So in her sense, she wants to very much speak to the somatic nature mm-hmm. of the disability that she has, and also to the limbs themselves, absolutely. I think also she likes the fact that the use of the term cripple. When else do we use the term cripple? Besides describing somebody who has a body of weak soundness or what have you.
Like an crippling incident is one where it keeps you from reaching your potential or something. I don't know if that's quite right.
Yeah, or like when we say, do we ever refer to things as being crippled or something
yeah.
crippled?
Yeah.
When would we say that?
Ships. Don't they say about ships? I think, a sailboat or something?
I think we think about any structure that's almost crumbling or failing or, mm-hmm. you know, and frail. And that sense of a falling away, I think, might be part of the exact thing that she's sort of embracing here about this thing, which is to say that my body is somehow sort of crumbling ever so slightly, but my acknowledgement of it is exactly her love, I think, of that term to some degree. Cripple also obviously is an embrace on her part because it's a part of the movement that was happening very much in the 80s and 90s and today, but was really big happening across the board in identity politics, which was a move of reappropriation of language. Right? So our gay example is queer, right? This term that's supposed to be a slur that you're supposed to hurl at people, right? Gay people in the 80s, 90s, and now reappropriate that term and be like, I like that term. I'm taking that term on because of the fact that it has a lot of hurt and pain in it, but I'm going to twist it. African-American communities use the N-word sometimes in that way in certain contexts and in certain to certain relationships. But again, it's the same move of reappropriation, taking a term that has with it a loaded history of hate, what have you, but trying to recontextualize it and to not wash out the hurt that's in it, but to acknowledge it and then to try to make a victory out of it in some way, to conquer that word, if you will, to some degree. That's what Mayers is doing, I think, here with the term cripple as well. Not just reappropriating it, but in some way embracing the hurt that might be in it and then taking that hurt, wearing it like a badge and being like, yep, I said it, that kind of thing, the swagger, right? I think that's the move that's sort of happening here. And that swagger that's happening at the linguistic sort of level, I think, is an almost compensation for probably the lack of literal swagger she's lost from the impairment that she has. I think it's a beautiful sort of like linguistic victory over the physical sort of impairment that's happening at that time. Any questions about these paragraphs? Let's turn to page 5. I'm just going to look at two more moments, and then I want us to jump right into the Leonard Davis piece about at the end of identity politics, because it does a good job of actually laying down this is what disability studies is. If we turn to page 5, can I get someone to read for us the two paragraphs that are in the middle of the page?
But I've been limping along for years now.
And then the next one after.
But I've been limping along for 10 years now, and so far George and the children are still at my left elbow, holding tight. Anne and Matthew vacuum floors and dust furniture and haul trash and rake up dog droppings and button my cuffs and bake lasagna and Toll House cookies with just enough grumbling so that I know that they don't have brain fever. And far from hiding me, they're forever dragging me by my racks of fancy clothes or through teeming school corridors or welcoming gaggles of friends while I'm wandering through the house in Anne's filmy pink baby doll pajamas. George generally calls before he brings someone home, but he does just as many dumb, thankless chores as the children. And they all yell at me, laugh at some of my jokes, write me funny letters when we're apart. In short, they treat me as an ordinary human being for whom they have some use. I think they like me, unless they're faking. Faking. There's the rub. Tugging at the fringes of my consciousness is always the terror that people are kind to me only because I'm a cripple. My mother almost shattered me once with that intrinsic mother's with that instinct mothers have, blind, I think, in this case, but unerring nonetheless, for striking blows along the fault lines of their children's hearts, by telling me, in an attack on my selfishness, we all have to make allowances for you, of course, because of the way you are. From the distance of a couple years, I have to admit that I hadn't any idea just what she meant, and I'm not sure that she knew either. She was awfully angry, but at the time, as the words thudded home, I felt my worst fear suddenly realized. I could bear being called selfish, I am, but I couldn't bear the corroboration that those around me were doing in fact what I'd always suspected them of doing, professing fondness while silently putting up with me because of the way I am, a cripple. I've been a little cracked ever since.
Great. All right. So she's talking here a lot about the relationship she has with her family, husband, children, and in particular, the gratefulness I think she has with their patience, but also maybe the suspicion that she has, the doubt that might be there. The term that she uses here, the rub that she mentions, is about the question of faking. Let's stop and talk about that term in relation to what Maris wrote, but I think just in general for disabled persons. Why is faking, and we can talk about what that means, such a touchy spot for Maris in particular, or why would it be a touchy issue for disabled persons? What is she talking about when she says faking, by the way? Somebody paraphrase what was just read for us.
They're dishonest. They're not being truthful with it.
About what?
About their support of her, their interest in her well-being.
Or their patience or impatience or what have you. Exactly, right? Which is to say they love her, but they put on a face like, no, everything's great, you're terrific. This idea that, like, there's a kind of dishonesty because of the fact that they don't want her to see how they feel. So what's difficult about faking then? What's behind that faking? In other words, for disabled persons, if we...
Pity?
Yes, pity. Absolutely. So this idea that, like, if they are and need to be to some degree an extension of her, if she can't trust how they're reacting to her, then there's some doubt there also about her place in this family and her own self. The pity that's there. Also, I think to some degree the kind of infantilization that might happen with the way that you might think about it. Sometimes, how many of us have not seen someone who reacts to another person who's hard of hearing or seeing, who's old and or frail, who's disabled, and you don't hear just a little bit of the tone of, are you talking to them like they're a kid, you know? Like, how are you? Let me help you right up here. There we go, you know? Like, it's supposed to be sweet and it's friendly, and it's a kind of patient extension, but there's a tinge of infantilization that sort of happens there as well. Deaf people have this the worst, by the way. Deaf people, because they can't hear, are often spoken to and talked to and addressed as though they're also limited up here, too. How are you today? Good. You know, that kind of thing. We're compensating for the inability to communicate, but treating the person to some degree as less than to some degree. So this faking that's happening here, and she's talking about her own family to some degree, really shows and I think reveals a kind of sensitivity that happens, not just at the way that, how is she going to call the condition that she has? How is she going to name it? But how is she also going to be able to read those around her in relation to her own identity and her own disability, if you will, to some degree? I mention these because I do not think these are Nancy Mayer's specific things. These are things that come with every disabled sort of condition or case, and that comes from the smallest sort of impairment to the most severe sort of quadriplegic, if you will, to some degree. And everything in between those same stakes of concern, labeling, faking, identity, conditions, community, I think are at play in all of the disabled studies. Yeah?
What really struck me is trust. You were saying trust with them, because oftentimes people with disabilities have to trust their families or their caregivers or whatever. They have no choice.
Right.
But they have this underlying, okay, if you're faking about this, can I really trust you with it? You know, and so that I think it would be something that was constantly on your mind, or you really going to be there for.
Mm-hmm. And just the fact that, let's be frank, too, she also, that worry of faking is important in the sense that, you know, she's still a mom and a wife and shit like that. Like, she wants to have that authentic, sincere, you know, really honest sort of like communication with somebody. And the disability, as much as it already is an impairment at the level of physically her own mobility or how she can interact with the world on a physical level, is it also have that potential to fuck up how I communicate with people and how honest they are with me? And it can, and it might. And I think she's aware of the fact that when we talk about disability, we think we're talking about the corporeal, we think we're talking about the physical, the body. But the fact of the matter is disability, because of how it renders and because of how it makes us feel as a culture, it can disable how we talk. It can disable how we read one another, and it can disable how we interact. And I think her call is that we need to just be mindful of that. Yeah.
She sounds like a very independent person. I think part of it is her fear of being dependent on others and just feeling bad that other people have to make allowances for her, and it sounds like it's something that she was battling with herself anyway, and then when her mother vocalized it kind of helped it ruined how she was reassuring herself that, okay, you know, people are telling me this, so maybe I'm not really a burden. And then she thinks, oh, wait, maybe I am, and they're just not mentioning it.
Yeah, and I think clearly this is the perspective of a woman who probably already was incredibly self-reliant before her condition came about. And so it's in the face of that that this is happening. But regardless, I think it's not that the condition gave her a voice. Her voice was already there, and the piece is almost an affirmation or a confirmation of the voice.
But I think that piece is actually really, really important, and I think it comes up in the deaf piece that we're going to talk about, where you have a person who's deaf all of their life with a capital D as compared to a person who might not have been. And this is a person who seems to have had the identity, didn't need to rely on people around her, had the self-reliance, whatever, and it's taken away piece by piece by piece through her illness.
Which is probably why she likes Cripple.
Right.
Because it's the taking away.
Exactly. So she knew from others. She knew from all of that. And then she has to deal with a changing relationship with people.
Everybody turn to page 9. I want us to look at the end of this piece because it speaks exactly to what we're talking about right now. And this is this idea. And this is actually the most controversial part of this piece, if you want to know the truth. This question about being, again, this connection of one's disability in contrast to one's able-bodiedness, which is to say, in thinking about disability narratives of all of persuasions, that in some cases we have the persuasion of somebody who is disabled and has no connection to a different kind of able-bodiedness. Maybe not 100% able-bodied, but a different kind of able-bodiedness. And then others, of course, the condition comes about later in life, and so there's an absolute direct connection, and this is the case that Nancy's talking about. One thing I want to bear in mind, too, is even the person who's born with a disability is going to have some other contrast to able-bodiedness. Now, it may not be able-bodiedness completely devoid of that disability, but there's always a range of what constitutes a good day or a bad day with my disability. So able-bodiedness is a part of everybody's perspective. Even the quadriplegic in bed that's comatose can have a good day or a bad day. So able-bodiedness is not off the table for anyone. Looking at Mears's piece, this is where I said it gets kind of controversial, because she's talking here about having a condition in the face of having no cure, and thinking about the possibility if there could be one. And this is the piece that really is, truthfully, the rub when it comes to disability studies. And I'm going to read it light here, page 9, starting with the first complete paragraph. The absence of a cure often makes MS patients bitter toward their doctors. Doctors, after all, are the priests of modern society, the new shamans, whose business is to heal, and many an MS patient roves from one to another, searching for the good doctor who will make them well. Doctors, too, think of themselves as healers, and for this reason, many have trouble dealing with MS patients, whose disease, in its intransigence, defeats their aims and mocks their skills. Too few doctors, it is true, treat their patients as whole human beings, but the reverse is also true. I have always tried to be gentle with my doctors, who often have more at stake in terms of ego than I do. I may be frustrated, mad, and depressed by the incurability of my disease, but I am not diminished by it, and they are. When I push myself up from my seat in the waiting room and stumble toward them, I incarnate the limitation of their powers. The least I can do is refuse to press on their tenderest spots. Now, this paragraph is clearly a kind of like recasting, if you will, to some degree, you know, her disability to some degree, to say it's actually the doctor's disability, which is to say that I think, let's be frank, I think she's doing a little bit of overcompensation here in the recasting of the story, but I think this is where her swagger comes from. I think this, it comes from that exact kind of like turn something on its head, if you will, to some degree. And it's not to say that she isn't right in some small morsel, which is to say I'm absolutely certain that a person with a condition like this, chronic or incurable as it might be, might prove frustration. And what she's showing actually is a kind of solidarity. I'm fucking pissed off that I can't be healed or cured to some degree, and I bet it pisses doctors off sometimes too that they can't fix it, because God knows it's probably true. It's wouldn't it be ideal if we could all walk out of this room, you better and me having done my job and made you 100% better. So in her case, rather than saying that as an alliance, she's also acknowledging the fact that I'm kind of intimidating then to some degree, which is also another reason I think she likes the term cripple. Cripple is an intimidating term, and for her, she'll take that intimidating term to some degree. Let's carry on. This is where it gets interesting. This is the penultimate paragraph here in this piece. This gentleness is part of the reason that I'm not sorry to be a cripple. I didn't have it before. Perhaps I'd have developed it anyway. How could I have known? I know such a thing, and I wish I had more of it, but I'm glad of what I have. It has opened and enriched my life enormously. This sense that my frailty and need must be mirrored in others, that in searching for and shaping a stable core in a life wrenched by change and loss, I must recognize the same process under individual conditions in the lives around me. I do not deprecate such knowledge, however I've come by it. All the same, if a cure were found, would I take it? In a minute. I may be a cripple, but I'm only occasionally a loony and never a saint. Anyway, in my brand of theology, God doesn't give bonus points for a limp. I'd take a cure. I just don't need one. A friend who also had MS startled me once by asking, "Do you ever say to yourself, 'Why me, Lord?'" "No, Michael, I don't," I told him. "Because whenever I try, the only response I can think of is, 'Why not?' If I could make a cosmic deal, whom would I put in my place? What in my life would I give up in exchange for sound limbs and a thrilling rush of energy? No one. Nothing. I might as well do the job myself, now that I'm getting the hang of it." The controversial part here is not the way that she sort of reclaimed the condition and decided not to feel bad for herself and that kind of shit. The controversial part here is the fact that if there was a cure, she says she would take it in a minute. Why do you think that is a kind of controversial thing to say? On the one hand, it sounds logical, but...
I have a different question.
Yeah.
Would she take the cure having never had the disease? Would she want to be that person, having never had suffered from MS in the first place? Would she want to roll back the clock?
Like Time Machine.
And never have that, and never have experienced that, and opened her eyes to all the other things she's seen? I'd like to ask her that question.
And what do you think her answer would
be? I think it would be no.
Probably
I want to
not.
Suffer through this because I've seen so much more of life through having suffered through this.
Which is the total pragmatic voice I get from her when she says, like, I'm not a loony. I'd love to be able to, like, walk normal again, right? Having said that, she's also pragmatic enough to know I learned a lot from having these conditions.
So I've had enough of it, and I'd like to change
it now. So if the pill came with an act of forgetting everything you've learned from having the condition, I bet you're right. I bet she would pause not to take it. After all, she could take the pill and get back her swagger, literally, and keep that swagger that she's got attitude-wise. But if she had to forget, she might lose that swagger that she talks about metaphorically. Anybody else? Thoughts about what's kind of controversial? Yeah.
Before we leave, after the statement, I'd take a cure, I just don't need one, I'm not sure I understand what she's saying, because what she's really saying is, it's opposite to what she's at both ends of the pole, so to speak. And
yeah.
I can't believe that she wouldn't want the cure, on a personal basis.
Yeah.
So does she mean something other than I'm reading into it?
Well, the word to hang on here is need, which is to say, would she want a cure if there was one? Sure, I'd want one, yeah. But do I need one to thrive in this life? Do I need one to be a complete person? Do I need one to be happy with my life? I don't think I do. So the distinction, I think, is between want and need, right? Which is to say, I'm going to survive without a cure because I've got the will and the fortitude and the right attitude. Having said that, it'd be nice to have the cure because then I could survive in a different, more capacitated way. Yeah.
So I'd suggest that one of the reasons this may be controversial is because she's changing teams.
Yeah, she's changing teams. She's letting go. As much as she's embracing that term cripple, taking that pill also means I'm not a cripple anymore. So it means letting go. And which is to say, what it changes is the very identity politics. We're going to switch to the Leonard Davis piece now if you pull it out. What I want to mention here is the very dilemma of identity politics. And what's controversial about cures? Because cures, while they seem to be about, we think of this in a very little sense, cures fix things. They repair damages that we have somatically, mentally, what have you, right? The truth of the matter is that cures also eradicate. And in the most optimistic sense, a cure eradicates a cancer, or a cure eradicates a virus in your body, or eradicates a bacteria or a fungus or something that's growing on you, right? But what they also eradicate then are labels, are terms, our identities that we have for ourselves, and as much as she is attaching, this is why I think when you said that, would she want to forget what she's lived through with the MS? No, because she doesn't want to eradicate that part of the identity she's got from this. They also have the ability to destroy communities. The most common example of this taught in disability studies, and disability studies, by the way, loves to talk about physical impairment, but one of their favorite disabilities to talk about is deaf people. Deaf people, because of the fact that we're talking about here, is the culture that's so important. Because deaf people have their own schools, their own churches, their own language, their own book, and they got, so let's just say they have all the features that are distinct to any other kind of culture. So deafness lends itself in the range of the state of disability so much to that question of thinking about how does disability function as a culture. In the case of deafness, it literally does. So thus, the recent advancement here in deafness are cochlear implants. Everybody familiar with these? Cochlear implants, which is to say, somebody want to tell us what a cochlear implant is?
It's a pretty significant surgery where they actually implant something
right
in your brain that enables you to hear sound again.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have any basic normal hearing, it destroys that. I mean, it changes.
It changes. Which is?
And you can't go back.
Yes, and a cochlear implant, then what it is an implant, it's a surgery, and it's a device that's both internal and external, actually. So a cochlear implant would mean somebody has invasive brain surgery. A piece or a chip or a device is implanted inside the brain, and there's also something external there, just a piece of hardware, if you will, to some degree. And what it can do is for somebody who has had deafness come on in their lifetime, or even somebody who was born completely deaf, it can actually provide for them some semblance of hearing. It's not 100% like hearing, and it's usually done in just one ear, so to speak. But what it can literally do then is provide hearing to somebody who does not have it, has not had it, or may have never had any kind of hearing. To that end, it sounds like this exact cure that Nancy Mayer has talked about. Would I take this cure? Sure I would, is what she's saying, right? Well, cochlear implants in deaf culture are the ultimate divisive thing, to the point where, since this advancement has happened in recent years, you can literally take the deaf community, if not slice it in half, you can certainly divide it into two camps. Pro, con, cochlear implants. What used to be a collated, cohesive, sort of like deaf community in the United States has totally become divisive now as a result of this. And the reason being that for many deaf people, this is a dream come true, a chance to actually interact with the hearing world in a way that they never could before. And for a whole other camp of deaf people, it's the demise of their very culture as a deaf community. And to that end, to get a cochlear implant or to be in favor of one is to be labeled either a victor or a hero or a turncoat and a traitor to some degree towards deaf culture. Now, I mention that because we're going to speak more about it when we get to the Terry Galloway piece on Mean Little Deaf Queer, but because that very stakes is what hovers over disability studies. Disability studies and readings of disability are not just about, like, let's read about a woman who's blind and hear what her story is, or let's read stories about what it's like to be sick or what have you. We're talking about the very existence of communities and identities, and that's very significant in the lives of the people who have these. And this is most extreme, probably talking about this deaf and cochlear implants example, but it happens throughout this spectrum of disability studies. If you turn to page 301, this is the first page of the Leonard Davis piece. Let's start with this left-hand column. You know what? This is from the Routledge book, The Disability Studies Reader. Routledge usually does really good readers on different subjects, but I hate how they did this one with these, like, two columns on every page. Mm-hmm. It's just, I find myself we're going to see this in a second. If you turn to page 93, left-hand column, I hate that. It's stupid. All right. And Leonard is the one who put this book together, so way to go, Lenny. All right. Left-hand column, I want to read through about three paragraphs here at length, because I think this will sort of lay out for us a little bit of the groundwork of the piece. So would you start for us reading on where it says, when I discussed the idea of clouding the issue, and then we'll just move down the next couple paragraphs.
Sure. When I discussed the idea of clouding the issue of disability identity, a prominent disability scholar advised me not to pursue this line of thinking. We're not ready to dissolve disability identity. We're just beginning to form it. While I agree that there is a strategic kind of identity politics one might want to pursue, especially early on in an academic or political movement, I also think that ignoring the current seismic shifts in identity politics would be equally disastrous and could lead to major instability in the near future. If disability studies were to ignore the current intellectual movement and plow ahead using increasingly antiquated models, the very basis for the study of the subject could be harmed by making its premises seem irrelevant, shoddily thought through, and so on.
In effect, we do have to acknowledge that, unlike race, class, gender, sexual preference, and the like, disability is a relatively new category. Although the category has existed for a long time, its present form as a political and cultural formation has only been around since the 1970s and has come into some kind of greater visibility since the late 1980s. The political and academic movement around disability is at best a first or second wave enterprise. The first wave of any struggle involves the establishment of the identity against the societal definitions that were formed largely by oppression. In this first phase, the identity, be it blackness or gayness or deafness, is hypostatized, normalized, turned positive against the negative descriptions used by the oppressive regime. Thus, black is beautiful, gay pride, and deaf power might be seen as mere reappropriations of a formerly derogatory discourse. The first phase also implies a pulling together of forces, an agreement to agree for political ends and group solidarity, along with the tacit approval of an agenda for the establishment of basic rights and prohibitions against various kinds of discrimination and ostracism.
In a second wave, a newer generation of people within the identity group, ones who have grown up with the laboratory models well in place begin to redefine the struggle and the subject of study. They no longer seek group solidarity since they have a firm sense of identity. In a second wave, the principals are comfortable about self-examining, finding diversity within the group, and struggling to redefine the identity in somewhat more nuanced and complex ways. Often this phase will produce conflict within a group rather than unity. We've seen this most dramatically in the feminist movement when second wave thinkers like Judith Butler have critiqued earlier essentialist notions that pulled the movement together initially. The conflict can come from differences that have been suppressed for the sake of maintaining a unified front so that the group could emerge in the first place and resist the formerly oppressive categorization and treatment.
Great. All right, let's stop there. So this is a very general breakdown about how to think about identity politics, but it's actually a pretty good one to think about, these two different waves that he's talking about. And this first wave, as he says, speaks to what? What's the ambition or the aim of the first wave of this kind of identity politics?
Uniting the group, like us versus them.
Got it. So corralling might be the word to use here, bringing together the various persons and parties that are involved in this particular identity, which is to say that it is about differentiating us versus them, if you will. It's about re-owning and reclaiming that sense of being othered, if you will, to some degree, to be in a way like, yes, and let's make a community out of the fact. So rather than feeling ostracized from the mainstream, let us various ostracized persons then come together and create our identity as a deaf culture, as a gay culture, as a black culture, you name it, what have you. So it's about finding solidarity, commonality, and common ground, if you will. The second wave, however, is what?
Yep. Finding diversity?
It is. Mm-hmm. So within that small nucleus, that group, if you will, to a degree, where is the diversity in there? So if the first one is about what do we have in common, the second is, okay, we have that in common, but what else do we have different, if you will, to some degree? So to that end, the first wave is absolutely about, there's attitude in both of those movements. They're both activist political sort of movement. So the first one is like the Nancy Mayer's piece, 1986, early disability. It's the, yeah, take it, I'm crippled, whatever. But it's being said towards non-crippled persons, towards able-bodied persons. And that act then of being a sort of like in-your-face, sort of like crippled person, really is also saying embracing, if you will, fellow crippled persons, if you will, to some degree. A second wave, though, is about saying to your fellow crippled person, I'm different than you, and I want to acknowledge that, if you will, to some degree. What Leonard is asking us to do in this piece is just not forget that we don't just need to do that first move. We don't just need to read disability narratives with which to acknowledge, reify, give credence to, if you will, oh, and that's what a disability identity looks like. We need to look more closely at where are there schisms, where are there fractures within disability studies. Because the truth is, as I said at the very beginning, and drawing that disability umbrella up there, we're going to find as we keep talking, that umbrella is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And as that umbrella gets bigger, that means we're corralling in a lot more, but that means in the second wave we're going to find a lot more divisiveness as well, too. In other words, the bigger you make the group, the more diverse it's going to get. That's just how it works. So too with disability. Turn, if you will, to page 303, left-hand column. I'm going to continue Leonard's narrative here with a quick sort of where he continues it in a couple paragraphs here. Left-hand column, enter post-modernity. The postmodern critique is one that destabilizes grand unifying theories, that renders problematic desires to unify, to create wholes, to establish foundations. One could fill archives with what has been said or written about the culture wars, the science wars, and whatever other wars. In terms of identity, there has been an interesting and puzzling result. The one area that remained relatively unchallenged despite the postmodern deconstructionist assault was the notion of group identity. Indeed, the postmodern period is the one that saw the proliferation of multiculturality. One could attack the shibboleths of almost any ground of knowledge, but one could never attack the notion of being, for example, African American, a woman, or gay. To do so would be tantamount to being part of the oppressive system that created categories of oppressed others. One could interrogate the unity of the novel, science, even physics, but one could not interrogate one's right to be female, of color, or queer. Leonard is asking us here then at this question to think about what does postmodernity do in the face of these identity politics? When he says postmodernity, what he's talking about here is this move, not just historically, but scholastically and intellectually, to which we question the veracity, if you will, of categories, of labels, of terms, of identities, of history itself, and of science and knowledge. To be postmodern, in its most subtle way, is really to just say, like, I don't know. Is it? I mean, that's what postmodern is, right? About everything. So, for example, a lot of religious leaders actually hate postmodernity because postmodernity says there's no such thing as truth. There is no stability, which is to say there's, well, what's moral? Who's to say? Well, what's a sin? I don't know. You know, that's what postmodernity does. It makes us question everything that we have to some degree. Nothing is fixed. What Leonard is pointing out is that we've embraced postmodernity in the academy and all different disciplines like crazy in the last, like, 30 or 40 years. Well, I don't know if it's a short story. Is it the end? You tell me. You know, that kind of thing, right? We've questioned it all the time, but we've not done it when it comes to whether it has to deal with one's gender, one's sexuality, one's race, and I think he's saying also one's disability. We're actually just now starting to do that. And I think we've not done it out of sensitivity, out of deference, if you will, to some degree, that we don't want to offend. After all, postmodernity has allowed us to realize, well, what's normal, right? And if we're saying what's normal, what's sinful, or what's not, we're actually citing tolerance is sort of the point, and therefore multiculturalism. But the next move, I think, that Leonard is pointing out then is, well, then what's African-American? Well, what's queer? Well, what's a woman? You know, these very terms that we've tried to be sensitive about are the ones that we need to ask as well. And he's saying disability studies is not like race or class or gender, which have much, much longer histories. You know, race goes on as long as time. Class, you know, deals with at least capitalism and probably much earlier, you know what I mean? Gender, as long as we can think of, there's been different constructions of gender. And sexuality is a very fixed category, is at least a couple of hundred years old, at least in terms of scientific and legal studies. Disability, as a fixed identity and group, we're still talking just into recent decades. And I think Leonard's call here to us is to think, just because disability as a study, disability as an identity politics, disability as a kind of community is so new, yes, we need to make sure it gets that first phase, that first wave of collation, if you will. But we can't say, well, let's not do the postmodern question, what is disabled thing on it just yet. It's too young. Let's treat it with kid gloves. He's saying we have to treat disability with the same seriousness and the same gravity as all these other different identities, which is to say we need to let it be a part of identity politics, but we also need to liberate it from identity politics. And what that means is that one, wave one, acknowledging what makes this identity, what makes this group, and two, what are its limitations and how can it break free and go beyond that. Looking on the right-hand column, page 303, he continues, disability offers us a way to rethink some of these dilemmas, but in order to do so, I think we need to re-examine the identity of disability, and to do so without flinching, without hesitating, because we may be undoing a way of knowing. As with race, gender, and sexual orientation, we are in the midst of a grand re-examination. Disability, as the most recent identity group on the block, offers us the one that is perhaps least resistant to change or changing thoughts about identity. And most importantly, as I will argue, disability may turn out to be the identity that links other identities, replacing the notion of postmodernism with something I want to call dismodernism. Turn the page. I am arguing that disability can be seen as the postmodern subject position for several reasons. But the one I want to focus on now is that these other discourses of race, gender, and sexuality began in the mid-19th century, and they did so because that is when the scientific study of humans began. The key connecting point for all these studies was the development of eugenics. Eugenics saw the possible improvement of the race as being accomplished by diminishing problematic peoples and their problematic behaviors. These peoples were clearly delineated under the rubric of feeble-mindedness and degeneration as women, people of color, homosexuals, the working classes, and so on. All these were considered to be categories of disability, although we do not think of them as connected in this way today. Indeed, one could argue that categories of oppression were given scientific license through these medicalized, scientificized discourses, and that in many cases, the specific categories were established through these studies. This is the part I want to get to here, where there's this umbrella we have up here. Is everybody familiar with what eugenics is? I'm going to erase some of this if you don't mind. Somebody tell us what eugenics is.
Potential breeding of a super race.
Say it again? Sorry.
Potential breeding of a super race.
Intentional breeding of a super race is definitely how we think about eugenics right now. So our most common example of thinking about eugenics would be the Holocaust, for example, the elimination of the Jews or the Roma or homosexuals or different less people. Or other kinds of racial genocide, if you will, in different places, are our examples of eugenics. Technically, eugenics, if you want to know the truth and the history of medicine, eugenics really just means prenatal, is really what it is. So the history of prenatal medicine, the idea that you would go to a doctor while you're pregnant, or that you would need to consult a physician or some other clinician to try to get pregnant, or that you would be concerned about one's own fertility or not, or what's the right thing to eat when you're pregnant or not, or what's the right amount of children for me to have, or who should have more kids and who should have less kids. That's really what eugenics starts as, but what it moves towards is exactly what you said. It moves towards family planning. The family planning moves towards social planning. Who should we render infertile? Who should we encourage to have children? Who should we eliminate entirely from the human population? And this is definitely a 19th century sort of move that's happening in the field of burgeoning field of biology that's happening at this particular time. And what Leland Davis was pointing out to us then is that this idea of eugenics, which is to say thinking about quality of life, how we should reproduce, but in particular quality of the human race, the stock, if you will, of the human race, really comes from thinking about these categories, gender, race, class, sexuality, if you will. To that degree, then, disability, while a mix, if you will, to some degree, in what constitutes able-bodiedness and worthy of reproduction, because it's not seen as an identity politics in the 19th century like the other groups are, it's postponed from being understood, if you will, to some degree, culturally, and thus it's so recent in how it's understanding. But what Leonard is arguing here is that disability studies, as it's so recent, it's the newest kid on the block, as he said, might actually mean that it might be the best kid on the block. After all, the umbrella for sexuality can only get so big, and the umbrella for certain races can only get so big, and the umbrella for certain genders can only get so big, if you will, to some degree. But disability, guess what, he's saying, historically, all of these things, the race, class, gender, sexuality, they all used to be considered disabilities. So while disability seems to be a niche group in recent academic studies, if you look at the long history of discrimination and eugenics and impairment, if you will, socially, disability actually might be the biggest umbrella of all. And that's actually kind of what's happened in the last 10 or 15 years, is that anybody who does queer studies or gay studies pretty much does disability studies now. Anyone who does racial studies or feminist studies pretty much also does some kind of disability studies. And the reason is that in the long history of those other identity politics, there was some connection to that identity, race, class, gender, sexuality, being seen as some kind of disability. So disability actually has a much bigger term and understanding than we actually think of. It's not just the person who has a wheelchair. It's not just the person who calls themselves crippled. But actually, it's this idea. This is how I like to describe it. Disability studies, for me, is equivalent to liability studies. How do we think about lives, identities, conditions, somatic, psychological, or otherwise, as being deemed in some way as impairments, liabilities, less thans, if you will, to some degree. To that end, what Leonard David is arguing here is an actual way in which what disability studies can do is allow us not to just see how different a life can be from the perspective of who's disabled, but actually how much we can have in common with somebody who might be, because everybody in a certain context can have some kind of liability. Any questions about that? All right, let's look at one more moment here. This is on page 309. This is a kind of articulation of what he says. To reiterate what I just said, 309, left-hand column, second full paragraph. What I would like to propose is that this new ethics of the body begin with disability rather than end with it. To do so, I want to make clear that disability is itself an unstable category. I think it would be a major error for disability scholars and advocates to define the category in the by now very problematic and depleted guise of one among many identities. In fact, I argue that disability can capitalize on its rather different set of definitions from other current and known identities. To do this, it must ignore the instability of its self-definitions, but acknowledge that their instability allows disability to transcend the problems of identity politics. In setting up this model, we must also acknowledge that not only is disability an unstable category, but so is its doppelganger, impairment. Which is to say that the impairment he speaks to is like the liability that's up there, which is to say that disability, as much as someone like Nancy Maris went through that list of terms and what's the right term I want to find for myself and how can I render fix it, if you will, to some degree, what I want to call myself, what my condition is. Leonard Davis is reminding us that there's also an instability that comes with all of those terms as well, too, because depending on the context, depending on the body that we're talking about, and depending upon what kind of way we're considering that disability, that liability, that impairment, those terms can mean any number of different things. And that's actually a rather liberating thing, I think he's trying to say for us. As readers, And as readers of narratives to some degree then, what these disability narratives provide for us, given this history and this very current sort of understanding of what disability means, and this means not just to academics writing in journals and Routledge or what have you, but means to actual disabled persons in their own communities, is that their debates and the stakes of their lives, and as we read those narratives, actually include us, because that umbrella can get so large that it can also include us. To that degree, the stories of the disabled then are not stories of others, but really, they're all of us. They're all our stories. Let's look at two more things in here, just to give you a little handle on what Leonard says, and then I want us to look at the Mean Little Deaf Queer. If you look on page 310, I want to mention to you this umbrella, how it gets bigger and bigger. It gets bigger and bigger, as I said, because terminologically, theoretically, we're changing who we want to include in what might be called disabled. We're thinking, under what circumstances might I be considered disabled, you know? So, for example, there are many, I'm a gay man, so there's plenty of places in the world where I would totally be considered, like, sick or disabled or criminal or any of that shit. So disability is not fixed because it depends on time, it depends on geography, it depends on culture. So these things shift and change, but there are other ways in which disability is growing. Here are some actual examples he mentions. Page 310, on the left-hand column. Indeed, the protected class will only become larger as the general population ages. And by the way, this label of disabled and how do we terminologically fix it really comes from the Americans with Disabilities Act and this idea that, all right, we need to figure out what falls under this category, this heading. And the truth of the matter is it keeps growing. Continuing on, with the graying of the baby boomers, we will see a major increase in the sheer numbers of people with disabilities. As noted in the introduction, the World Health Organization predicts that by the year 2020, there will be more than 690 million people over the age of 65, in contrast with today's 380 million. So if disability has to deal with being elderly and infirmed, we're going to have a lot more older people. It's getting a lot bigger. Two-thirds of the elder people will be in developing and underdeveloped nations. The increase in the elderly population will cause a major change in the disease patterns of these countries. There will be increasing rates of cancer, kidney failure, eye disease, diabetes, mental illness, and other chronic degenerative illnesses, such as cardiovascular disease. Although we may want to call all these senior citizens people with disabilities, what will that mean? Will we have to start making decisions about who is disabled and who is not? What Occam's razor will we use to hone the definition then? And how will this majority of older people redefine disability, since they did not grow up with a disability or acquire one early in life? Who will get to claim the definition of disability or the lack of one? So with the increased number of people who are living longer, with the increased number of illnesses that we can render chronic or livable as opposed to just something that might be fatal, what we're actually doing is making more and more and more disabled people, if you will, to some degree, to the point at which disability might actually be not just the fact of whether one is disabled right now, but whether or not someone might be disabled at some point in our life. And depending on how we see the statistics working out or how the terms that we're using, I think we could safely say at some point in our lives, almost all of us will be disabled to some degree, depending on these definitions. To that end, this umbrella is just getting really fucking huge, which is to say Leonard thinks that's a great thing. Yeah.
Couldn't we rely on technology to like limit what it means to be disabled? Like shouldn't that be what we should be expecting that, shouldn't we?
Give me an example, what do you mean? I'm sorry.
Take an amputee, for instance, they would be considered disabled. The technology can sort of create a prosthetic.
Take a deaf person. Once a deaf person gets the cochlear implant, are they still disabled? Technically, they're still deaf. They have to have an implant that helps correct or compensate for that.
Right.
You could go either way, I think, on defining or not. And this is the hard part, actually, in the deaf community, if you want to know the truth, is that this idea that, like, if I got the technology to help fix my condition, do I then cast off the term that I have? Whether that term is deaf or disabled or impaired to some degree? Or do I claim both now? Now can I both hear and be a deaf person? Is that possible? These are, you know, technology, the point about it is that technology is both the intimidating thing to these communities and identities, but it might also be the thing that makes these communities get even larger, if you will, to some degree. So the answer to your question is, I don't have one, you know?
And then you have to prove if you're disabled enough.
Right. And this is where the American with Disabilities Act comes in, and this is where insurance coverage comes in, and this is, which is to say there is a point in life where you have to draw a line in the sand and say, does it count or doesn't it? Whether it's legal protections or insurance wanting to pay for it or the hospital saying you need to stay another day or you can go home today. There has to be a point where that happens. Leonard is just saying culturally, That expansion and contraction is happening in just how we think about it every day in our lives. It gets fixed in moments when it comes down to usually dollars and cents and numbers and statistics, but that shifts too and that changes on context and historically too. So for example, what constitutes a disabled person in terms of, give you a great example, what constitutes the definition of a child being an asthmatic has changed significantly. So there's a lot more kids that have asthma right now, and everybody talks about the fact that like it's environment and it's because they're not exposed to enough things, and it's true. There are some of those factors, but it's also the fact that the definition has gotten, you know, so that what meant being an asthmatic has actually gotten lower. So.
And most people don't care until you go to the entitlement programs where they're entitled for services. So then you have to get the definition.
Well, and the definition then becomes
assuming they're going to get them and they're not going to be cut off at some point. The future is to prevent this umbrella from growing. I mean, that's the
future is to prevent this umbrella from growing? In healthcare, you mean?
The healthcare issue, if they're going to be entitled to the technological advances that will occur and whether or not the government's going to pay for them, because if the government doesn't and private insurance doesn't, and it's unlikely the government can continue, and I'm not getting into political issues, but financially, the government can't continue.
Well, that's the rub. The rub isn't whether one has access to the services. The rub is who's going to pay for it.
That's
different. And that's where the line in the sand has to be drawn. And that's not an affront to disabled people. It's just there's only so much funds to go around. But that's where it becomes very contentious. And the point of this kind of discourse about culturally disability expanding is that it at least informs and rubs up against what do we do at the level of financial and services and statistical sort of models of those definitions. And I think Leonard's point is the fact that we don't have to be so hard-lined on either end, whether we want to have the umbrella big or whether we want to have it small. The point of the matter is, how do we define disability? Well, guess what? It's negotiable. So let's sit down at the table and try to negotiate it out to some degree. Let's look at one last thing I want to direct you to in this particular article. This is on page 312, where he talks about just a couple of, it's actually 311, excuse me. He just mentioned, I want to just direct you to three little phrases he used to direct us to how we can think about disabled bodies in a different way, that we aren't just thinking about what does that body look like or what can't it be capable of doing. He mentions on 311, if you notice there's the very last paragraph in the right-hand column, a new ethics of the dismodernist body consists of three areas. The first concerns the official stance, which he calls a care of the body. Turning the page, the next paragraph says, another official area pertains to care for the body, an area that links the economic with the body. And then the next paragraph says, finally, to secure a dismodernist ethics in opposition or in some cases in alliance with the official stance, we need to discuss caring about the body. This is the area I would most like to emphasize, which is to say that those concerns we have about how to define disability, how to think about, well, what's the right thing to think about a body disabled clinically? What's the right way to define it economically? And what's the right way to define it culturally? I think these are the three terms he uses for those very categories: care of the body, care for the body, and care about the body. And how we expand or contract that definition of disabled, I think, depends upon context. Those contexts can be historical, they can be legal, they can be geographic, they can be cultural, but I think they can also be clinical versus economical versus just social to some degree. And to those degree, and if you're just listening to the fact that there's a way to think of care of the body, for the body, and about the body, that isn't just prepositional semantics, I think, on his part. I think those are actually an acknowledgement that to consider disability studies and to consider disabled persons and to consider disabled identities, the very term, is just to say you got to look from different perspectives for, about, and by disabled persons. Let's stop there and turn to Terry Galloway's Mean Little Deaf Queer. Let's look at just a couple of moments, but I'll start by telling you a little bit about Terry Galloway. She's a famous artist and writer. She is a prominent lesbian, gay woman author, but also a prominent person in deaf writing. And this particular text I like so much because of the fact that it actually thinks about those two identities, not in contrast, but in tandem. And I think that's interesting because I know this a lot when I teach queer classes that I have to do some, when I have to teach things about like queer theory and race or queer theory and disability or something, questions almost always come up, especially if I have a guest speaker, for example, who might be an African-American gay man. someone almost always asks, so what do you consider yourself more, African-American or gay? Like, there's always this idea that one has to choose between the identities. And some people do pick one more than the other. They're totally entitled to. But the idea is that one doesn't have to. And I like this text because I think it's a kind of text where she's grappling with the fact that she's having a hard time choosing between those two. So what she chooses to do instead is to find how they're actually alike, where they have common ground. When I spoke to the idea of deaf culture being so distinct within disability studies because there's such a clear culture to it, I see so many parallels between deaf culture and between queer and gay lesbian culture for a number of reasons. One being, of course, the fact that there are communities and centers and a kind of fellowship that happens in the level of those identities, which seems to be incredibly institutionalized and incredibly cultural, if you will, to some degree, and global. So which is to say that if I went to a deaf community in Japan, they have a different sign language, but you would see a lot of the same cultural features that you would in a deaf community in New Jersey or what have you, right? Likewise, if you went to a gay pride parade in Philadelphia in June, and then you went to one in Bangkok, you know, 2 weeks later, they would look a lot alike, you know? Just to say there's a dissemination of the culture that seems to be global, that happens a lot in queer culture and deaf culture. The other thing, too, is that there's a kind of community that happens and a kind of family building that happens that's very horizontal. So, for example, a deaf child may absolutely be the child of deaf parents, but not necessarily, and not usually, which is to say, then, that community that child belongs to quite often is horizontal. It's with other deaf people. It's not just vertical with my parents and grandparents and the children that I'm going to have, but there's a real kind of fellowship that happens across within a single generation or within a particular sort of age group. Queer culture is like that, too, since... guess what? Most gay people are the byproduct of heterosexual couples. And that's just procreation facts, which is to say that, you know, a lot more straight people out there and a lot more of them having kids than gay people. So that to that degree, then, the fellowship that happens isn't always with parents before them, but necessarily with people across the lines. So to that end, this Mean Little Deaf Queer piece actually sort of seems to me to kind of reify or sort of exaggerate, I think, that interesting kind of fellowship, such that if there's a kind of alienation she's feeling as a deaf child or as a queer person, finding fellow persons to fit that mold to some degree has both allowed an acceptance, if you will, of that identity, but also, I think, to some degree, a kind of like creation of her own sort of like sense of worth in both of those identities. I had the term up here before, faking, right? And we had that up there before because it was about, do people fake their reactions with the disabled in order to make them feel more comfortable, or to make them, usually to make the person who isn't disabled feel more comfortable in that situation. Well, this piece is about faking too. It's faking at the level of what we refer to as for the person who is making them uncomfortable. Passing. Everybody familiar with this term, passing, when we use it culturally? It actually has a long history in terms of racial politics, such that somebody who was, for example, born in the South in the, say, 18th century, if they were light-skinned enough that they could come across as white, they might pass themselves off, which is to say that it's a way in which you sort of conceal or hide to some degree. She has this at the same time here talking about her deafness, which is to say that she has some hearing ability and lost her hearing ability slowly in fits and starts over her life. So it was an attempt to try to pass, to seem like you aren't a disabled person. And this is another kind of faking that's at the stake of a lot of our disabled study stuff. And in queer culture, we have that too. It's called being in the closet, right? It's this idea that like you're going to try to pass, you know? So if I'm going to try to pass, I'm just going to butch it up a bit and not talk about my boyfriend, like that kind of thing, you know? That's a kind of passing act too at the same time. But that's what hovers over, I think, a lot of these disability study narratives too. And I think for her particular kind of disability, where it's a degenerative sort of one, and for her particular kind of culture, wherein we're going to find out, she grew up in a household where she wasn't the child of deaf parents and she didn't get to learn sign language. She just tried to speak as well as she could and read lips as well as she could. So the strategy then was to conceal, to hide, if you will. Consider that in contrast to all the things we've been talking about, disability as being something that you're supposed to claim as a badge of honor. I say all that as a kind of like prefatory sort of moment. So if you turn to page 73 of the Galloway piece. If I could get someone to, where do we leave off reading? You want to read next? Start with the first paragraph on 73, and then Mary, you want to do the next one, and then we'll talk.
Information moved me to take up the non-hearing exercises I used to indulge in when I was I put my hearing aids aside, stretch out of my bed, and get myself ready for what's in store. The mattress trembles with every passing car, and so do I. When a train rumbles and chugs along the tracks 3 blocks to the north, my body rumbles and chugs right along with it. Thunder shakes the walls of the little house where I live, and the shocks of it make the headboard and my heart quack. Lying there awake, two long breathes in me the deep unease, a fear that I ought to be feeling something I'm not. My longtime love, Donna Marie, calling for help in the back room. Our cat, Tweety, yowling piteously to be let in. These are the times when going deaf the way I have, it in fits and starts, seems almost akin to dying. I'm losing, will lose, have lost. And each step of the way, my body seems to have been trying to tell me something new, something it seems I ought to have known all along.
In 1961, the year after I was diagnosed, my body reached a tipping point, and I began to lose my hearing in big old chunks. It was a loss as erratic and unsettling as the Ukrainian train schedule. I blew the best of my sound, and my hearing was stabilized. A day, a week, a month later, whole conversations would fade into gibberish. Familiar noises like a car in the refrigerator would simply vanish, and I'd have to adjust all over again. One late afternoon, I fell into a doze on the couch, listening to my parents' muttered, lazy Sunday conversation, then woke 1 or 2 minutes later to what seemed like nothing. For 2 days, even my own voice was an echo in my head.
Okay. Let's just start just straightforwardly here and talk about what kind of emotions are you hearing her talk about her deafness and her connection to it. Yeah, I think there's an unpredictable as the prognosis might be for the condition, so too seems to be her connection to the condition itself. In other words, I don't know what's going to happen to me in my hearing, and I don't know how I feel about this. I think I'm hearing a bit of both. Anyone else? Thoughts on these couple of paragraphs?
Well, I knew I would have been so scared and so frightened, and I don't hear that from her.
Frightened? Well, there's a kind of, this is hindsight, I think,
yeah,
too.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I think this is the hindsight of, like, that's the lines like a Ukrainian train, you
yeah.
know? Like she's being a bit sort of, like, jokey, I think, jocular, if
okay.
you will, to some degree. But I think that's a little bit of the...
terrifying.
Time has given her confidence, I think, to yeah. some degree, to look back on it. And it's a very funny memoir, the whole thing, if you
yeah.
have a chance to read it.
It was read so calmly, I felt like it was a very peaceful transition.
A peaceful transition.
Yeah, kind of ended it all. You know?
Yeah, I mean, there's, which is to say, it's kind of interesting then. There's the content of this is, I don't know how I feel about my condition, but the confidence of the prose itself sort of belies that fact, which is to say, I think that's not a unique sort of thing, especially in a memoir. After all, most memoirs are written after great rumination, after a great deal of time has passed, but they're recounting events quite often when something traumatic or tragic was sort of happening. So to that end, the content of the piece itself is probably rife with tension and problems, but the mastery of the prose to describe it suggests a kind of conquering, if you will, of an experience, which is to say that that's the, I think, the hallmark of a successful memoir, which is to say, if it can give you both the unease of what happened in that moment, but deliver it to you with such mastery and effective prose, because of the fact that there's been hindsight and catharsis, if you will, afterwards, that's a good memoir. And I think we're getting both here. I think we absolutely are. If nothing else, through the way in which the emotions come through, but the humor does too, to some degree. Turn, if you will, to page 78. This is where we take those emotions that speak to the beginning of that particular this particular section, and now we actually get to what we define as this little d, big D deafness that we're talking about here. Who wants to continue reading for us? You want to take it? Yep. You want to take it from there, and then Leslie, you want to do the next paragraph after her?
Which paragraph?
This is on page 78, top of the page, as a child.
As a child, I didn't pay much heed to other deaf children because I didn't know any. The deaf as a people don't regard themselves as disabled, but simply a culture entire, like the Amish. And, like the Amish, they keep to themselves. There's a definite hierarchy in the deaf culture. If you are deaf of deaf, a deaf person born to deaf parents, and your language is sign, and the company you keep is primarily deaf, you are deaf with a capital D. If you are hearing born to deaf, and you sign and live and play primarily within the deaf community, your blood is still pure. It dilutes a bit with every variation from those first golden means, but lowest on the deaf totem pole are the waverers like me who came to deafness gradually or late and were mainstream to be part of the hearing world. As a general rule, we suck at sign. My own sign is on par with my Spanish, which can get me to the bathroom, but after that, nada. We are known as the little D deaf.
Good.
growing up, I knew none of this. I was 25 before I went to my first deaf gathering, and I was taken aback to encounter hostility and suspicion there. When I introduced myself as deaf, over-enunciating and gesturing broadly with my hands, one of the women signed to me furiously, her eyes getting harder by the second she realized how little I understood. I wasn't deaf, but deaf. And when she signed the lowercase d, I could almost smell its rotten tang. I'd gotten there thinking I'd be embraced like a prodigal daughter and instead found myself under fire. For, so I thought, the same curse that had befallen me at the Lions Camp for Crippled Children, not being disabled enough. Hostility makes me hostile in return. It was all I could do not to stick out my tongue and grimace and posture like a warrior. I walked out of there thinking they were a closed provincial bunch and I was better off outside their preachy little circle. I remained smug in my lowercase superiority until a few years later, when I developed a crush on a deaf woman who was a consultant for the PBS television series for disabled children I was co-writing. She spoke as well as signed, and it was she who told me these stories.
Okay. Let's talk a bit about this cultural distinction that's mentioned on page 78 at the top. The deaf are like Amish, which is kind of, it's a good comparison. They're kind of like that. And actually, deaf culture, if you want to know the truth, it wasn't just cochlear implants that was a threat to deaf culture. It was also sort of like different kinds of funding and institutionalization. Deaf culture is huge in the first part of the 20th century, and in the late 19th century, which is to say there were giant schools for deaf and communities for deaf, numbering in the thousands of people who lived there because of the fact that there was, again, a kind of like well-intended segregationist sort of happening back to create these very distinct sort of very large communities. It was only in the middle of the 20th century where we started with this very notion, this term that she calls here mainstreaming. We've all heard this before, right, about kids who are, you know, disabled or impaired or have learning disabilities, or this idea about like mixing gifted kids with not so smart kids. It's this idea of like, let's mainstream everybody. And that kind of mainstreaming in various educational and clinical and sort of like therapeutic sort of regimes is really what was one of the first things that challenged these large deaf communities. This idea, is it advantageous to let these people be part of the mainstream, if you will, to some degree? Having said that, that's what hovers over the debate of cochlear implants of late, and what hovers over this anecdote that she provides for us here. She mentions three different categories here, but let's see if we can't think of a few more. The first one she mentions is if you are deaf of deaf, which is what? Got it. So I'm like mom and dad. None of us can hear. Done. That's category one, right? And that seems to be the holy family, if you will, to some of the equation, right, about what the... That's capital D, capital E, capital A, capital F. Like, that's deaf, apparently, according to this, right? Top of the totem pole. Number two, she refers to as hearing born to deaf, which would be what?
Parents are deaf, you're...
That's right. My parents can't hear. They're deaf. But I grew up in a deaf household, and therefore all my people I interacted with were deaf, so I can sign like as though I couldn't hear a thing, but I can actually hear. So you couldn't tell, in other words. In other words, I'm a hearing person, but I could pass, absolutely, because I've got that skill set, basically, based on my parents. The third category, which is not mentioned here, is this one that you said, which is to say, I'm not deaf. I mean, I'm deaf, but my parents can hear, but I also know sign and all that sort of stuff. That probably also would fall into this category of what she says here is, your blood is still pure. So I'm assuming the deaf child of hearing parents, but one who has been fully integrated in the deaf community, might also pass this test. She, however, is this category that she calls bottom of the totem pole, which is the waverer, if you will. So this person that, let's see here, deafness came gradually, strike one, right? Number two was trying to be mainstreamed. Strike two, sucked at signing. And Spanish. Three, right? Right? So there just seems to be, and tried to pass, probably, as hearing, so to speak. So her skill set is probably much more on the lip reading end of things rather than on the sign sort of things. So all of that speaks to your blood not being pure, and also a bit of the, and this passing thing being, is this person a traitor? Is this person not really one of us to some degree? Now, the interesting thing about this memoir and why I love this is that Terry Galloway, as she's talking about this too, is at that young sort of age, she is telling us now with great savvy this whole thing about the deaf and Amish, but she's also admitting that I had no idea any of this was really going on. I didn't know where I stood. In fact, she talks about going to this meeting thinking she'd be the prodigal daughter, and instead, like, she gets there and tries to say, I'm deaf or whatever, and they're basically like, don't overdo it, honey. You know, you're not really one of us, that kind of thing, right? It's basically the assessment. So, but I love, my favorite thing is not the reaction that she gets, but that she goes in there not even expecting that particular kind of reaction. To that degree, what we're talking about here, and this is sort of wave two, right? The two wave Leonard Davis is talking about, this is the wave two. There's great distinctions within disability groups and identity politics, so to speak. And now we're seeing one of those schisms here, if you will, to some degree. What do you make of the fact that she didn't have this. For example, do you think that this inability to be given the capital D deaf is something that she's deriding here in this particular moment? Or is it she proud of the fact that she's not a capital D person? This is a chapter that's called Little D Deaf. I mean, let's not forget, we started with Nancy Meyer's piece on being a cripple. We talked about what's the right term to call oneself, right? The name of this piece is Mean Little Deaf Queer. So she's embraced being queer, like I said, reappropriated that term, and taken on deaf. But this episode is called Little D Deaf. Again, I think as a kind of like, I'm taking on that term. Yeah.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's another challenge that she, I think, overcame. Like, you know, not sure, being sure where she was, finally thinking that she found this community where she's gonna be accepted, not being accepted because she wasn't, you know, like deaf and disabled enough, and then overcoming that and being like, well, okay, I'm okay with this. So I think it's just another challenge that she's faced in her life that she's come to terms with.
I think so too. I think if deaf is the first term that she's supposed to claim, I am deaf, I'm proud of it, I accept it. I bet you she is of the ilk now. When she signs it, she does it with a lowercase d. Suck it, that's me, you know? I have a sense that that's probably what she would be doing too, which is to say that the reappropriation of the term happens not just in contrast to the mainstream, phase one, but happens even within your own community too. So this act of adorning or taking on a name or an identity, it's not a thing you do once in your life, but you do it over and over again. I taught a whole class here at Penn about 5 years ago in queer theory. It was all about the closet and coming out of the closet or what have you. And the point of that class I taught is a theory I firmly believe, which is everyone always asks, like, if you're gay, like, oh, when did you come out of the closet? As though the reaction is going to be April 17th, 1995. Like, there's a specific date. Like, the truth of the matter is I came out this morning, you know. every time I meet somebody new, you have to come out, or so to speak. So the same thing with taking on this label of disabled or crippled or what have you. You do it every day of your life, and sometimes over and over again, and quite often to yourself over and over again. You do it on the big picture, and as she says here, you do it in the small community too. So I love that in the sense that as much as those terms expand and contract, as we said, it's because of the fact that we have to constantly do it over and over again every time we take on a label. Yeah?
I think, in looking at how does she define little D deaf versus big D deaf, they did talk about, like, if you were a kid who was born, let's say you just were born deaf, but to hearing parents, unless you pursued the community, they would label you little D deaf, even though, you know, you think about little D deaf versus big D deaf, you kind of think, oh, okay, if somebody lost their hearing, or, and so you kind of have to embrace it because that's all they're going to let you, this is your only option. And so I think she really claims it there a lot, because you know, it would be a big hardship if you were deaf your whole life, but maybe you didn't have the support to find a deaf community to help you out, and your parents were kind of like, yeah, this is yours, deal with it. And then you get this label.
Yeah.
Then, you know, there could just be all these compounded things that you're like, whoa,
yeah,
I can't believe this is all happening to me. So we...
And I think that is what this book is, the narrative is that. It's this idea that her parents were probably very well intended in what they wanted to do to mainstream her and make her pass, if you will, to some degree. But the truth of the matter is that deafness was still a part of who she was. And there was some point in her life where she realized, I need to reach out to other people who are like me for fellowship. And this is, I think, where the queer part comes in too, right? Where it's this idea that, like, you know, she didn't know when she was born that she was queer. You know, you find out later in life, is just you become aware of yourself and your desires or what have you. And eventually you need to reach out to others, act on that desire and that expression. And I think deafness is no different, which is to say then she had to come out on both counts, if you will, to some degree. The only hard part is, given that hierarchy of deafness and the multiple permutations that can happen in families of deaf children or parents or not, what have you, is that she just got the bad luck of the draw, and she has to come late to the game, trying to be a part of the deaf community. And in many ways, I think that's what this little episode is, and I think what the book itself is saying is that I can become integrated in a part of this deaf community because I had to do it coming out as a gay woman, so to speak, and I might follow that same playbook. It means other people are capital D and deaf, and they've been a lot longer than I am, but that's all right, you know? I'll catch up and do it in my own time and own way. Yes?
Like the whole idea of the hostility, he makes me hostile in return, and like that's probably where the woman that was a little bit attacking her identity in the first place must have gotten hostility from something, but that's part of the problem in any kind of small group.
And yeah.
I don't know, like, and I guess it's hard, like, where does it break? You know,
it is. I mean, this is just group dynamics, isn't it? I mean, it's the fact that, like, this is the woman who's been at the group a long time, and therefore she's like, oh, honey, don't even try. You know what I mean? Right? But you know that woman, when she first came to those meetings, someone said to her, oh, honey, don't even try. Right? So it's just a little bit of group dynamics that's going on here. Of course, the difference is, of course, is that we're talking about one's own body and one's own identity at the level of that. So the stakes are that much higher. But, yeah, it's totally not unique to the deaf community anyway. I think it's...
But she also puts herself in a certain hierarchy. Not only is she little D, but at the same time, she's one of the best lip readers. So, you know, she's sort of, whereas other people can't do that at all.
Yeah.
So she's sort of.
She's got some skill set, yeah. Turn to page 89. I want to look at another episode in here before we move on. This is the bottom of 89, where she actually starts talking about this connection, if you will, to some degree, between deafness and queerness. Bottom of 89. My queer impulse was the other thing I was trying to get under control. I think I must have suspected I was queer from age 5 and was happy to discover its sexual component at age 7 with a blonde my age named Sunny during a game we called, and to this day I'm embarrassed to remember, Milking the Cow. You can well imagine. Around age 13, I was finally able to put a name to my inner roilings when I looked up the word homosexuality in a dictionary. I had heard my older sister use the word with some vehemence when describing to my parents how she'd stumbled upon her female college roommate in bed with a woman, and the fact that I found the context intriguing made me suspect the word had particular relevance to me. The definition in the dictionary, sexual desire directed at a person of one's own sex, thrilled me to death. But I wanted further clarification. I thought I was being immensely discreet when I offhandedly mentioned at dinner that night that I'd looked up homosex. I didn't even have to finish the word. It was like I'd shot off a gun and a stampeded cattle. The commotion caused left me the wrong impression that homosexual was the wrong side of the sheets to be on. The dictionary mentioned desire, and that's how I imagined homosexual, as being in the throes of longing. I knew longing. It seemed a pretty okay state to be in. Longing had moved me to work hard for all my teachers, but especially the women, because they were gentle with me, and that gentleness, besides making me less afraid of disappointing them, made me yearn to please them. That yearning only intensified with Suzanne, who reintroduced me to the pleasures of my own senses. She was passionate with me, passionate about what she saw as my talents. She took chance after chance on me by entering me into dozens of speech competitions. When I finally won a big one, a statewide competition in the reading of poetry, she and her husband at the time took me out for lobster, and she gave me my first sip of champagne right out of her own glass. All right. Tell me, looking at those two paragraphs that I just read, what do you think about the first paragraph when she talks about homosexuality, but literally looking up the term in the dictionary, saying the word or part of it, two-thirds of the syllables or whatever, at the dinner table? What do you make that this paragraph says to us then about the power of these very terms and labels that we have? What's Galloway's point, you think?
Somebody is mixed, you know, like the term, you know, Latin isn't used anymore. So I think he faced the same problem. You know, he was expected to be accepted, but he wasn't accepted.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, are you black or are you white? You know, are you gay or so a lot of times people think that, you know, gay people are poor people.
Mm-hmm.
They don't face similar challenges, and they say it's not even equivalent.
Yeah.
Equivalent struggle, but it seems like it is based on.
Yeah, and I think it's very much that in this, as we see in this paragraph, in this episode, that kind of lack of tolerance or that kind of discomfort isn't just with what the identity is, what the person is, but also the very term itself, which is to say then, for example, I know this to be the case. Lots of people, you know, are fine with somebody being gay, but just don't say the word around me or talk about your sex life around me or any of that kind of stuff. Don't even talk about your private life, you know what I mean? So the discomfort is not with the thing itself. Shit, you know, Susie over here can sit in the room with a gay person, but if a gay person starts talking about their gay life, it's the hearing about it that becomes the discomforting part, not the proximity to the person themselves. And I mention that to say that, to some degree, sometimes the thing we call an identity and the identity itself are the same thing, but sometimes they're very different. So to that end, I might not be uncomfortable with Nancy Mayer sitting next to me with MS, but I might be uncomfortable with her using the term cripple. I'm not sure. And recognizing that difference, that distinction between the term we use, the label we give, the narrative we provide, and the thing itself might actually show the power of this particular kind of word choice, if you have to some degree. Her reference to the word homosexual and the way it lingered on her and the way she saw this vehement reaction from those around her gave her the chance to see the potency in that word, how discomforting it can be, how dangerous it can be, but how powerful it can be at the same time. Thus, the strategic, I think, decision about, do I call myself homosexual? This isn't called mean little homosexual queer. She did mean little deaf homosexual. I mean, she decided to say queer. She decided to say deaf, and if you notice in the title, it is capital M, capital L, lowercase d, queer, right? So there's a very strategic way with which the term we use to describe ourselves. And I think this is not unique to gay, this is not unique to deaf, this is not unique to disabled. But in fact, as Leonard showed us with disability, it's something that might be make the umbrella very big in terms of what we have in common. What do you make of the second paragraph? This first woman that she sort of has, develops this crush on, this teacher. And by the way, I find it rather interesting the context with which she finds the crush on this teacher. What is the big thing this teacher praises her for so much? Speech competitions. Which speech competitions are basically for whom? They are. And these ones, actually, though, are these statewide speech competitions are probably ones for deaf kids. I'm imagining Terry Galloway with hearing impairment didn't win the state forensics competition. I'm just going out on a limb here, right? I'm imagining these are competitions, and there are these competitions, that encouraging deaf people to learn how to speak, you get the award if you pass the best, right? You sounded the least like a deaf person, so you win the award. So there's this weird thing here where this desire she's recognizing in her attraction to this teacher is being played against the fact that she's being encouraged in this competition that's basically about the idea about trying to, like, speak, if you will. Speech, by the way, was also one of those divisive issues also in the deaf community. Does everybody know who Marlee Matlin is? She won an Oscar for Children of a Lesser God in the 80s. Well, she won the Oscar. This is a movie about a woman in a deaf school, and it's a good movie. And she won the Oscar for Best Actress. She was, like, 21 at the time, really young. And she won the award, and she went on stage, and she looks terrible if you ever see the pictures, like baby's breath in her hair. But anyway, she did the whole speech, and she did it in sign, and she got the award, and it was great. And then the next year, as is protocol at the Oscars, whoever wins Best Actress, the next year has to come back to present Best Actor, and vice versa. Well, she came back the next year, and when she had announced the nominees for Best Actress, she spoke them all, rather than signed them all. And people thought that was really brave. And on the other hand, some people in the deaf community thought that was a real turncoat sort of move. Like, why is she trying to pass and speak? You know what I mean? It's not like she sounded, she had just been learning to speak in that past year. So she didn't totally sound like not a deaf person, but it was just the mere gesture of that. On one camp, it was rendered heroic. And on the other side, it was seen as sort of villainous, treacherous, if you will, to some degree. This speech competition episode seems interesting to me in that there's one identity is being coached while another is being couched, if you will, to some degree. And I think that sort of tension is happening throughout this particular narrative. I want to direct you to one little moment in this piece before we move on. We're going to look really briefly at Rosemary Garland Thompson's piece, and then we'll probably call it a day. This is on page 99. We're not going to read this paragraph together, but I want you to take a closer look at it if you got a chance. It's the top of page 99. The paragraph that starts, "I was growing up pre-Americans with Disabilities Act." Which is to say, this distinction between am I deaf or not, and does that D have a capital D, or deaf have a capital D or lowercase d? The benefit of a thing like the Americans with Civil Disabilities Act is absolutely not just the services it provides, but it is the kind of litmus test with which one can look to say, well, technically, do I fall within a definition requirement of what disability is? And now, being disabled doesn't have to end or begin and end with the Americans with Disabilities Act. But having these institutional definitions absolutely does provide a kind of like touchstone, if you will, towards identity. The Americans with Disabilities Act is absolutely important then because, I'll give you an example, not just the way that it gives credence to whether one is disabled or not, but absolutely whether one gets the services and responsibilities. So a big move in the Americans with Disabilities Act was in the 1990s, HIV and seropositivity was added to that list as a chronic condition. So disability could also include the services and protections that came with that particular act. So that before its inclusion in the Americans with Disabilities Act, AIDS could be seen not just by the individual who had that condition, but by the government, by institutions, by municipalities, and by persons in the general population as a particular kind of thing, whether it be just a disease or a rightness or a wrongness. But once it gets brought into the fold of disability, and this goes back to that faking we talked about before, disability immediately evokes from us not just a bit more patience and a bit more rights and responsibility, but also a bit more sympathy, if you will, to some degree. On the very negative end, as I said, we render pathetic and infantilize the disabled, but we sympathize with them. To that degree, the big advancement, for example, in getting seropositivity or HIV positive status in the American Disabilities Act wasn't just the protections that it granted, although that was a big part of it. You couldn't fire somebody for having AIDS and that kind of thing. It was that it rendered more sympathetic than people with AIDS too, because they fell under this umbrella of disabled. So keep that in mind as we're talking about what constitutes disabled or not. And Galloway's paragraph here saying before or pre-Americans with Disabilities Act is to say there wasn't that document to confirm, am I disabled or not? Is that a good thing? And is it something to sympathize with or not? That's one of the stakes also to think about. All right, let's turn to Rosemary Gollan Thompson. We'll go through this just a couple of moments. All right, this is on the first page, Beholding by Rosemary Gollan Thompson. If you're interested, there's going to be a disability studies conference here at Penn, just out of curiosity, in April. And I mentioned it only, it's one day on a Friday, but I mentioned it because Rosemary Gollan Thompson, Leonard Davis, pretty much all the leading disability theories people are going to be at Penn for the day giving talks. So keep your ear out in case you're interested. Rosemary Gollan Thompson teaches in the Center for Women's Studies down at Emory. She herself is someone with a physical disability, but she's a scholar in queer theory, in disability studies, and in feminist scholarship too, as well. And her interest is very much with studying disabilities and gender identities and sexualities, but in particular how we think about them and how we see them. This piece is called Beholding. And in particular, this piece is about how do and when should we look or not look at people who are disabled. I'm going to read the first couple of paragraphs for us. This is on the section called The Ethics of Looking. We all stare. Sights that stimulate our eyes, the magic show extravaganza, the burning towers, the twisted cars on the freeway, lead to wonder, horror, or just thrills. When we stare at one another, as we have seen, things get more complicated. We are all potential starees as well as starers, and between people, staring is a communicative gesture. Between strangers, staring is uncomfortable, especially in the intense, prohibited, baroque staring that does not disguise itself. That discomfort can be positive, however, rather than oppressive. A stare is a response to someone's distinctiveness, and a staring exchange can thus beget mutual recognition, however fleeting. In this way, how we look at one another can be a productive aspect of our interpersonal, even our political lives. If all this is so, then the question for starers is not whether we should stare, but rather how we should stare. The question for starees is not whether will we be stared at, but rather how will we be stared at. As a productive, albeit volatile social relationship, staring necessarily brings with it these ethical dilemmas. All right, so the stakes here is to think about what is the humane, what is the appropriate, what is the polite, maybe, but what's the best way to interact visually with people who are disabled? So, this is called, the terms she's using here are staring, and she's just saying, everybody stares, okay? So the solution here is not to tell people not to stare, it just sort of happens. The moment she wants to get to is beholding, and what she's gonna come from is this area of scholarship called gazing, or the gaze, if you will, to some degree. To start off with, let's start here, where she does. Staring is the important one because really it's one of the important first lessons we learn about the disabled when we're children, right? So, the young child that points, what's wrong with that woman's face? It's a woman who's a burn victim, or why does that man have a wheelchair, or what have you? The response by the parent, or the guardian, or the teacher, or whoever has to be there, usually tends to be able to stop looking at them, or something to that effect. To that degree, we shouldn't gawk to the idea. And why shouldn't we gawk? Why are we taught this when we're kids?
Impolite. Makes the other person uncomfortable.
It might make the other person uncomfortable. It objectifies them to some degree. It makes you point out the elephant in the room, if you will, to some degree, right? It's the thing that we're supposed to just treat it as normal, right? It's the same, treat it as something that's just every day, you know? So somebody who comes in who's missing both of their arms, we're just supposed to not flinch, not look, you know? To that degree, we're basically faking, aren't we? Mm-hmm. We're not just faking at the level of flight, we're faking at the level of, it's totally normal, you know what I mean? Like someone came in and they were missing an eye or half their face, totally normal, right? Whereas the person who has that condition might be glad that you aren't overly gawking or being like, ew, or pointing or something, but faking also seems to be a lack of acknowledging too at the same time. Which is to say that The intention is good when we tell children or tell ourselves not to stare at people. Our intention is we don't want to objectify or be rude to that particular person. But when we don't look at someone, we also ignore at the same time. We don't talk, we don't give them some sort of like credence, if you will, to some degree. To that end, staring is important. So looking at people who are disabled is absolutely essential because it gives them not just validation, it almost renders existence, if you will, to some degree. To that end, she wants us to move towards beholding, Rosemary Darwell Thompson does. And the reason is we've been so apt not to, even scholastically, to do this is because there's a history of what is called the gaze. Is anybody familiar with the gaze as Foucault describes it? Foucault, a French philosopher, talked a lot about what he referred to as the clinical gaze. This is from his book, The Birth of the Clinic. The clinical gaze is this idea that there's a certain way with which people get looked at, and bodies get looked at within the hospital, within the clinic. And how they get looked at is a way that's totally more than what they literally are. So for example, this is an example I love to use. There's this great novel by Henry James called The Bostonians, okay? And it's about this young girl named Verena Tarrant, who is a great speechwriter, but she's very beautiful. And this is in 1890s, so to speak, Boston. And the whole idea is that this beautiful young girl could be the great next speechwriter for the feminist movement that's coming about in Boston at this particular time. So a very leading feminist woman named Olive Chancellor, who's probably in her 50s, but very dowdy looking, but very smart and very for the feminist movement, sees this beautiful girl and sees her as this great speaker. So there's one time where the woman is giving a speech, this young Verena Tarrant, and Olive is looking at her saying, isn't she brilliant? She just really is. Her cousin, however, is from the South, a man named Basil Ransom. Appropriate name, right? He's a dashing man, probably in his 30s, you know, very handsome. He's played by Christopher Reeve in the movie version, so you know what I'm talking about. He looks at her giving a speech and he goes, I'd be much more convinced if she was giving that speech on the kitchen table in my house, right? Which is to say he wants to domesticate her, he wants to own her. Cut to the last character was a character named Dr. Prance, a female physician in Boston at this time. Dr. Prance looks at the woman giving the speech and she goes, I think she looks anemic and probably eats too much candy. That's the clinical gaze, which is to say that Dr. Prance could look at that body and say, she's pretty, or she made a good speech, or I like her, or I don't. But there's a kind of endowed skill that comes with the clinician or comes with the person of medicine to be able to look at a body and say, you know, I could be not trained as a clinician, and a clinician could be trained next to me, and I could look at that growth on your arm and be like, ew, or, you know, because I can describe it, brown, about 3 centimeters in circumference, or what have you. The clinician could go, well, look at melanoma, blah, 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 and also in his head could be imagining what might be under the surface of that particular. That's an empowered kind of gaze. And that gaze is good. It's absolutely where great diagnosticians come out of, because it's the ability to see a body, and that gaze happens not just with the eyes, it happens with the ears. Foucault, one of his favorite things to talk about is the stethoscope. After all, the stethoscope is using your ears in order to picture and imagine what you're seeing and what might be internal. And that kind of penetrative gaze, that kind of ability to look at a body and determine what might be happening physiologically to that, is a kind of power that a clinician has. And now Foucault just tells us, we got with that power comes great responsibility, so let's just be mindful of that, and let's be aware that we need to check that gaze, so to speak. We need it, but we also just need to be mindful of it. Well, cultural studies, persons of all kinds, in the wake of this belief by Foucault, jumped on this idea of gaze studies, which is to say, what are other kinds of privileged form of looking? And to that end, it became a kind of policing, if you will. So what does it mean to think about the masochistic gaze, or to think about the feminist gaze, or to think about the cinematic gaze, or to think about the socioeconomic gaze, or to think about the racist gaze? And how do we different ways we look? So visual studies become obsessed with how are we objectifying people, and all that work is great. Rosemary Gow Thompson comes in by saying, think about how we talk about disabled people and we're not supposed to look at them. Then think about academically in the wake of this gaze studies. Now we've got even more reason to just be suspicious of how we look. She's just trying to say, there's nothing wrong with this kind of suspicion, but there's also a good side to looking too, and let's not forget that. And sometimes that looking is also staring. So there can be a way to stare that's not just impolite, but can actually be informed. So what she is advocating for here, the ethics of looking, to be honest with you, is not being smart about knowing to look or not to look. The ethics of looking is how are we good when we're savvy lookers, when we know we look the right way, with the right informed information behind us. When do we know it's a gaze, and when do we know that it's not? And I think this is where the act of beholding comes in for her. If you look on page 200, I just want to direct you to a term that she mentions in here, and this is the italicized term on the left-hand column. Sorry, I wish I had a dollar for every time I said left or right-hand column today. All right, on the left, she mentions the term Schadenfreude. Is anybody familiar with that term? She defines it here, taking satisfaction in someone else's misfortune. It's this idea that, like, we sometimes stare at things because we find them fascinating or beautiful or lovely or great, but we also stare at things sometimes because, you know, we can't look away. It's so awful and so terrible, but we're taking kind of pleasure from seeing how awful it is. It's that whole, like, you know, when someone says, like, it's a train wreck or something, and you're like, I can't take my eyes off it for some reason. It's why, you know, oh, there's a terrible car accident, drive by, rubbernecking, right? Rubbernecking is sort of that bit too, which is to say curiosity, but there's a bit of Schadenfreude in there too. She's just trying to say that that's another reason we curtail or we cut ourselves off from trying to stare at people who are disabled, because we don't want to give the impression to the disabled person, nor do we want to admit to ourselves that part of the reason we look is we're taking a little bit of Schadenfreude out of this, which is not to say that we're like, ha, 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 she's in a wheelchair. You know, we're not that kind of villain, you know, so to speak. But we are watching and thinking, that's curious, that's interesting, or that's different. And I think what Rosemary Garland Thompson, she herself a disabled person, would be is to say, great. You can absolutely have someone come into the room and they're missing a limb and look at them and stare at them, because what you're saying is, yes, you are exceptional. There's something different about you, and I'm acknowledging it by looking at you. And it's not just the equivalent of saying, let's show the elephant in the room, but let's actually give prominence, let's give acknowledgement to that which is different about someone. And it doesn't have to be Schadenfreude, but it's okay if it is a little bit too, I think is what she's saying. If you look, if you will, on 204 and 205, I want to direct you to just two little things she mentions. This is under the section called visual activism. Okay, I'm just going to read this paragraph here on visual activism. It states, by putting themselves in the public eye, saying look at me instead of don't stare, people such as Matsuka and Johnson, these are two sort of artists, photographer, performance artists, who were playing up their disabledness as a part of why you should be objectified looking at me. Called visual activism is what she's calling this. In 1993, Matsuka exposed her scars and commanded, you can't look away anymore, to make the public accountable for knowing the reality of her body. 10 years later, Johnson presented herself on the same New York Times Magazine cover to make the public accountable for knowing that people like her can flourish in their own distinctive way. In doing so, these twin cover girls, I like her use of that term, put to work a three-step process of visual activism. Look, think, act. And I'm going to say that again because I think this is the ethics of looking that she's talking about, and this is where we are beholding rather than just gazing, where looking is essential, but looking comes with two other things. Look, think, act. First, they use the human urge to look at new things to make people look at them. Second, they use the way they look, the way we look at them, and what they say about it to ask the public to think differently about people like them. The last step depends on the starer's receptiveness. If their visual politics of deliberatively structured self-disclosure succeeds, it can create a sense of obligation that primes people to act in new ways, to vote differently, to spend money differently, to build the world differently, to treat people differently, and to look at people differently. And this, I think, is the most important thing that Rosemary Garland Thompson is saying about looking and about the value of staring and about beholding. Because according to this line of thought, look, think, act. We are allowed to look. We must absolutely think. And the reason we must act, and it can be things like voting and shit like that, but it can also be just the fact that you think differently, or you believe differently, or you'll look at a disabled person differently the next time, which is to say that gazing is important because it's transformative. It has the power to change us. So why would we deny ourselves that pleasure? Not just as lookies, but also as lookers as well, too. We do a benefit then, not just to the disabled person when we look at them, we do a benefit to ourselves if we do. And therefore, that obligation, that intention, that instinct to not want to look, isn't just ending up being bad for the person because we're not looking at them, it's bad for us too. And the reason is, and I think she's absolutely right, we think looking, and we want to by default think looking, is about objectification. How I see you, and that there's a receiver and there's a director in that particular relationship. But what she says, and she's absolutely right, is that the act of looking is there's reciprocity. It goes back and forth. And so thus too is the give and take that comes from it. So that idea that we shouldn't look or that we shouldn't behold a disabled body is really an attempt on our part, I think, to be intimidated by that very transformative, reciprocal, sort of like powerful act that comes with staring or gazing. It makes sense why we shy away from it instinctively, but I think it's all the more reason, as she would say, that we should do it and we need to do it. Now, this is not a call for us to all go out and go sit in the handicapped parking lot and just wait to look at people. Just look at them, you know? That's not the point, right? But it's this idea that we shouldn't feel like we have to curtail that instinct that we have in ourselves. I want to direct this one last thing on here, and this is on page 205, left-hand column, last time. A term she uses, and I think it's a good one. And I want, as we leave today, just to think about what this term means in terms of disability studies, but in particular, I started with this and I want to end with this. This week is important. I know we went through a lot because all of the various dilemmas, variables, identity politics, naming, labeling, reappropriations, all that shit, get used to it because we've got about 3 or 4 more weeks of it coming up. Next week we're talking about cancer, the next week we're talking about AIDS, we're talking about mental illness. The stakes are the same. The umbrella may be different, but it still expands and contracts.